Welcome and thanks for listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and coming up next, an analysis of the NDAA. What is the National Defense Authorization Act that President Obama recently signed into a law, accompanied by a signing statement? Delilah Lithwick explains the bill's content. She is a contributing editor at Newsweek and a senior editor and legal correspondent at Slate, where she specialized in covering the Supreme Court and judicial issues.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dahlia Lithwick, who's a contributing editor at Newsweek and a senior editor and legal correspondent at Slate, where she specializes in covering the Supreme Court and judicial issues. She's the co-author of Me Versus Everybody, Absurd Contracts for an Absurd World, a legal humor book. And in 2001, she was awarded the Online News Association's Award for Online Commentary. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dahlia Lithwick.
Thank you for having me.
And Dahlia, I've been getting some very concerned letters from listeners about what is actually in the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act, that the president signed on Saturday. And I've also gotten letters from people who have contacted their senators and congressmen, and they've sent me the actual text of the bill, where their senators and congresspeople have assured them that there are no U.S. citizens or legal residents are affected by this bill, and yet people are out demonstrating. They're demonstrating in Iowa, you know, on the basis that American citizens can be disappeared by the government. So clearly there's a lot of confusion, and I'm laying it on your shoulders to straighten this out.
Well, I think, you know, the predicate is exactly correct, which is you have some groups like the New York Times, Glenn Greenwald, the commentator at Salon, the ACLU, laying it out in the starkest terms that you've just, you know, offered up, that this absolutely for the first time codifies that Americans captured on American soil can be detained indefinitely without charges and without due process. Then you have a lot of other takes at this, including, you know, the enormous number of Democrats in the Senate who voted for this thing, who are saying that is just blatant misrepresentation, that this has been completely spun as, you know, a violation of civil liberties, when in fact all it really did was codify the status quo. And so, you know, the real true answer is, I think that the thing is sufficiently ambiguous that both of those things are true, and that as it progressed and as it was tweaked and tweaked again and tweaked in order to satisfy the White House's concerns, there were sufficient waivers and loopholes and, you know, bells and whistles added in that nobody really quite knows exactly what this incredibly ambiguously worded bill does. And then the president went ahead and signed it into law on New Year's, but he did it in such a way as with a signing statement that was even more layered and nuanced and ambiguous. So if the question is, what does the law do? What does it change? I think that the fundamental change, regardless of all the language and the specifics and the loopholes and the waivers and everything else, is that for the first time Congress gets in on the act and codifies powers that certainly the Bush White House and the Obama White House had given themselves. They had rooted it in the AUMF, the Authorization of Use of Military Force, which you may recall was passed by Congress in 2001, right after the attacks. But these were powers that the executive branch had asserted, both the Bush and the Obama executive. This is the Congress, for the first time, saying some of these powers, many of them, including very controversial ones, like waving people into military trials and possibly waving even Americans into military tribunals, those things are now, as a matter of law, signed and sealed by the Congress. That's what's really dramatic here, is that we have two of the three branches of government now saying that the kinds of presidential powers that were asserted after 2001 are in fact the law.
So in the signing statement that accompanied the president's signing of the NDAA last Saturday, he seems to have mostly singled out that foreign fighters captured in the U.S. will be held in military custody outside the reach of the civilian law. And Obama has said no, he wants the flexibility that perhaps law enforcement could provide a better method of incapacitating the terrorist threat. So what else in the signing statement caught your attention?
Well, I think that he's being very careful in the signing statement to try to track the language of the Supreme Court in the 2004 Humdi versus Rumsfeld decision. And that was the only time, really, that the court weighed in very, very foundationally on these detention questions. I mean, the AUMF, the Patriot Act, didn't really speak to detention. So it was the Supreme Court in 2004 in this 5-4 majority opinion in Humdi that really did lay out what the, you know, what the scope of the universe was. And in Humdi, the court, as I said, 5-4 majority, written by Sandra Day O'Connor, saying that it was that the due process clause of the Constitution bars the government from indefinitely detaining a U.S. citizen in military custody. So that's the law at this time, and that's really what the signing statement picks up on. And he tries, in effect, to reword that law and say very, very clearly. And because this was really being debated at the time, Section 1021 of the Act may, in fact, apply to American citizens. It's not clear. The Act expressly does not apply 1022 to American citizens, and so there's a provision that may apply to American citizens. And in his signing statement, Obama goes out of his way to clarify that his administration will not do that. Now, the really important thing about signing statements, and I probably should have said this at the very beginning, is that they're not the law. They're like a little sticker that the president affixes to the law, and he says, this is how I interpret this, but it doesn't mean that it's the law. The law is for the courts to determine. And so the really critical thing to think about when you think about the signing statement is, yes, it's a pledge by the president that he's not going to apply this very controversial provision to American citizens, but that doesn't bind him, and it certainly doesn't bind the next president. So I think it's really important to understand this is a little, you know, a signing statement is a little bit of the president crossing his fingers behind his back and saying, you know, I'm going to say that this bill is constitutional and I support it, but these are the bits of it that I'm going to interpret in a different way. But that doesn't bind President Santorum or President Ron Paul to interpret it that way. And that's what really makes these signing statements so very terrifying that I guess that on its face, it's nice that the president is promising us what the bill doesn't do, not going to apply to American citizens, but it doesn't have any legal force. And it, as I say, it doesn't bind future presidents at all.
But it does seem, Dahlia Lithwick, that the president's signing statement in this regard, where he says, under no circumstances will my administration accept or adhere to a rigid across-the-board requirement for military detention, it seems to be more about prerogatives and process and not about the issues that concern civil libertarians.
Well, the really, really important piece of that is that, and this was something that really, as the bill was being shaped in order to mollify the White House, became very clear. The White House's objective in tweaking this bill and in saying it would veto the bill, and in that sense really shaping the subsequent versions of the bill, was to preserve flexibility. The White House was not worrying about the things that the ACLU was worrying about. And I think it was a mistake when folks thought, oh, Obama's going to veto this bill because, you know, it fundamentally violates the rules of posse comitatus, you know, that you can't have the military doing domestic police work in this country, that it fundamentally violates habeas corpus. Those aren't really the principles that the White House was threatening to boycott. What the White House said from the beginning, and remember, as this bill was being worked on, everybody in this administration, from FBI head Robert Mueller to CIA chief David Petraeus, said they hated this bill because it made it harder to fight the war on terror. But again, what they wanted to preserve was flexibility. They wanted to have the option to have as much executive authority as they could, and in a deep way, this bill binds their hands. This bill comes about, as I said at the beginning, not because Congress wants Obama to have more power. Until 2008, Congress was out of the game of detention and interrogation and all that stuff because they deferred to President Bush when he asserted that he had the power to do that. It was only after 2008 when Obama said, you know what, I'm going to close Guantanamo. I'm going to try terrorists in domestic trials. I'm not going to try them in military tribunals, that Congress really gets into the business of setting up laws that not to give the president more power, but to, in fact, give him less power. So that was the real problem, the sticky wicket for the White House, was that they want to have the option to either try folks in the military or to try them in civilian courts. So they wanted to have the option to try Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in New York. When that option gets taken away, and that's explicitly taken away in one provision of this bill, that's the deep objection that you're hearing from the White House. So I think it's a mistake a little bit for folks to think that the White House was really, really concerned about the same civil liberties issues that, you know, the folks who are writing into you are concerned about. The White House wanted to make sure that it could maximize its own authority and that it wasn't answering to the Congress for the first time since the war on terror began.
You mentioned Guantanamo. There is, of course, a political element to this, since this bill was driven by John McCain and Lindsey Graham. And I think in many ways, McCain is a very bitter man about losing the elections, and he says some rather nasty things, even for a politician, about President Obama's ability as commander-in-chief and his legitimacy as commander-in-chief, particularly his criticism of the withdrawal from Iraq. So it seems that the political dimension here is that the Republicans, and McCain specifically, were stitching up the president so to foreclose forever his promise, whether he was going to keep it or not, to close Guantanamo. And would this, in a political context, would this be in the category of the old Republican canard during the Cold War that the Democrats were soft on communism and now it's, of course, being soft on terrorism? And is that why so many of these Democrats voted for this bill? Because that's the amazing thing is, I don't know what the final number was, but it was 90% of them went along with it, right?
Oh, that's absolutely right. I think that the thing that is really breathtaking, if you step back and look at this, you know, the sweep, the 10-year sweep, since 9/11, the sorts of things that are precluded by this bill and by the talk of people like John McCain and Lindsey Graham are the sorts of things that the Bush White House would have thought were indefensible. So that the Bush White House had no problem Mirandizing terrorists when they were caught. The Bush White House had no problem trying terrorists in civilian court if it suited them. The Bush White House was far more generous in its assumptions that, you know, some folks go to military tribunals, some can be tried in civilian courts. It only comes about after, when Obama gets voted into office, that the presumption is that the mere act of, for instance, Mirandizing the underwear bomber or giving him a lawyer, that those things become soft on terrorism, even though Jose Padilla was given a lawyer initially. And so I think it's quite right to say that this isn't really about we have to do whatever we have to do to be tough on terror, because we didn't believe those things when the Bush administration deployed them. I think it's a one-way ratchet. I think you're absolutely right that things that were inconceivable several years ago, you know, the suggestion that you could indefinitely detain someone without charges, certainly that's power that the Bush administration aggregated to itself and assumed for itself. But I don't think the rhetoric would have been that comfortable to say, yeah, we're going to, you know, toss people in jail and throw away the key. There was always the promise that, oh, eventually Hamdi and Padilla will get due process. So we are far to the right of where we were even in the Bush era. And I think it's absolutely because there is no loud and vocal constituency for being soft on terror. And even though we have tried hundreds of terrorists in civilian courts, and not a single terrorist has escaped from a domestic prison and perpetrated more acts of terror, it's a one-way ratchet in which we only get tougher and tougher and tougher, and we forget all the successes of the civilian system. We forget the absolute abject failure of the military justice system as it's currently constructed at Guantanamo. And instead, we only err on the side of becoming more and more punitive and more inclined to call Obama soft on terror. Now, the great paradox here is, of course, it was Obama who in the end of the day, was the one who killed the perpetrator of 9/11. It's been Obama who has, like it or not, kept us safe from more terror attacks in the last couple of years. And so the way you make the political point that you're making, that despite all that, he's still soft on terror, is to say that we will absolutely not even give him the option of doing the kinds of things that Bush had the option of doing, like a civilian criminal trial or like moving someone out of Guantanamo.
Well, it seems, just to buttress what you've been telling us, Dahlia Lithwick, that the president is more concerned in these signing statements about presidential prerogatives than he is about civil liberties. He apparently, in the signing statement, expressed his opposition to a provision in the bill that bars the transfer of detainees to foreign countries, which has been referred to as rendition. Mm-hmm. So he's basically saying, I'm in favor of rendition, and I'm not going to adhere to this ban on rendition. That certainly strikes me as not being soft on terror.
No, I mean, and he's authorized drone strikes, and he's authorized, you know, the execution of, you know, foreigners abroad. I mean,
American citizens abroad
without due process. So in many, many ways, he has been much more inclined to use executive power in what I would say lawless ways, even than the Bush administration. And moreover, I think, you know, over and above rendition and executions and drone strikes, the things that he objected to in the Bush administration. So, for instance, the Bush administration was using this thing called the state secrets privilege to keep things like torture from being tried in courts. Obama objected to the use of that privilege, and then as soon as he became president, began invoking it to keep torture from being litigated in domestic courts. So he's continued many of really the worst excesses of the Bush administration, and it's, as you and I have both said now, it's sort of wrapped in this language of flexibility. We need to be able to pivot on a dime, and we need to be able to use all of the courts and the systems that are available to us. But I think that in the end of the day, what the NDAA unequivocally does, it makes it harder for him to be flexible. It makes it, if the next underwear bomber comes along and he attempts to try anyone, I think, who's a terror suspect in a civilian court, it will be virtually impossible to do that. It's going to be virtually impossible to ever close Guantanamo. So I think that even though he's protesting that he's going to hold on to all this flexibility, I think the net effect here is to cut him off at the knees and force him to look like he is weak on terror because he's being kept under the thumb of the Congress. So I think you're quite right. A lot of this is simply optics on the part of the Congress and certainly on the part of the Republicans who pushed the bill. And in a deep way, I think the president's signing statement is about optics. I think it's about saying, I'm going to hold out for the kinds of flexibility I demand, even though, having threatened to veto this bill, I'm now signing it.
So, Dahlia Lithwick, what are we left with here? You're suggesting now that presidential powers that we were alarmed about, that Dick Cheney claimed and usurped in the Bush era, are now being consecrated. And now that, not just in the executive branch, but in the legislative branch, that just leaves the judicial branch. Will there be any kind of a test case that will get to the Supreme Court? I mean, the idea that our last hope is the Supreme Court makes me extremely nervous.
Well, as it should. I mean, I think it's important to remember that, you know, one of the strongest voices that emerged at the Supreme Court against the idea of indefinite detention for civilians belonged to Antonin Scalia. So it's really useful to remember. And, by the same token, it was Rand Paul, who made the most passionate pleas for killing the NDAA as it is currently conceived. So I think this doesn't necessarily track any sort of normal left-right as you and I have been talking about it. I mean, I certainly think the gamesmanship and the posturing tracks left and right, but I think that some of the staunchest opponents of this bill were conservative libertarians who find it as horrifying as you do and some of the folks who wrote to you do. But that said, I think it cannot be a good thing when you have two branches of government putting their imprimatur on the legality of this. And I think one of the ways that the courts have tried very hard to push back on the excesses of the Bush War on Terror has been to say, oh, you know, the executive can't unilaterally assume that it has this power. That's a much harder thing to say if you look at the sort of wartime power cases. It's a much, much harder thing to say, oh, this is illegal, when both the Congress and the President have expressly signed off on these powers. And so I think in a deep, deep way, this does tie the hands of the courts in a way that the courts were not burdened before. Now you have two of the three branches saying, oh, of course, this is perfectly constitutional. So I do think cases will bubble up. I do think that there are going to be, as a result of this, some egregious, egregious civil liberties violations in the coming years. I think people are right to say the very ambiguity of the bill is what we should worry about most. But I think that the belief that the courts are going to push back when you have Congress expressly putting its stamp on presidential powers that were once only assumed and assumed, you know, as you said, in the mind of John Yoo and Dick Cheney, is in the net a very, very worrisome thing. I think it's going to be very hard for the courts to push back now.
Well, just in closing then, Dahlia Lithwick, a lot of people who are concerned about the NDAA, and there have been demonstrations in Iowa by Occupy the Caucasus, which is a branch of the Occupy movement, specifically against the NDAA, and I've spoken to a number of activists here in Los Angeles with Occupy LA, and they're very concerned that this is a slippery slope towards the criminalization of political expression, and even though it's hard to find exactly where the threat to citizens and legal residence is specified, when you have a situation in this country where the police have become militarized through Homeland Security's largesse, you can just see the pepper spraying and these kind of Star Wars trooper look that they have now, even though we're at a historic low, according to the FBI, in crime rates in this country, it doesn't look like that when you look at the way the police are gearing up for what. The question is, what are they gearing up for? That's what terrifies activists. The combination of chipping away at posse comitatus, allowing the military to police the streets of the United States, the drop in crime, and the sense that maybe what this is all going to be used against is civil dissent.
I mean, I think you've answered your own question. I absolutely agree that, you know, there has been a wall between what we do militarily and what we do in terms of domestic crime fighting, and that is posse comitatus, and it has been the law for a very long time for good reason, because Americans understand what happens when military force is used domestically, and it is a slippery slope. I'm thinking as you're talking about warnings we had back when torture was supposed to be limited to Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo and how it's migrated into the United States, because that's what happens when you allow something to be used in a, quote, war on terror, which has no boundaries and no borders and no enemy and no end, then you are allowing it to be used on your own citizens at the end of the day. And I do think people have a very legitimate concern about the militarization of the police in this country, and about the way that the police has massively over-responded to the Occupy protests and to other protests. And all of the data that I have seen about the use of the Patriot Act provisions, which were ostensibly passed only to make us safe from terror, but were in fact used overwhelmingly in the war on drugs in this country and to fight domestic protesters. All of that says to me that when you give this kind of unbounded power over to the executive branch and over to the police and over to the military, you are asking for it to be used in wrongful ways against citizens, and that folks should be really, really concerned about that part of it. That, you know, you and I can sit and parse, you know, Section 1021 and 1022 and the waivers of around those until the cows come home. But that's not really the worry here. The worry is that there is a principle that is allowing for military detention, possibly for Americans in some settings, indefinite detention. And that we don't believe in that as a constitutional matter. We don't believe in that, and that we should be very, very worried about that trend in law enforcement.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Dahlia Lithwick.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Dahlia Lithwick, who's a contributing editor at Newsweek and a senior editor and legal correspondent at Slate, where she specializes in covering the Supreme Court and judicial issues. She's the co-author of Me Versus Everybody, Absurd Contracts for an Absurd World, a legal humor book. And in 2001, she was awarded the Online News Association's Award for Online Commentary.
You can hear great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly all your life. You were only waiting for this moment to arise. Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these sunken eyes and learn to see all your life. You are only waiting for this moment to be free. Blackbird fly, blackbird fly, into the line of a dark black night. Black night. Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly all your life. You are only waiting for this moment to arise. You are only waiting for this moment to arise. You are only waiting for this moment to arise.
That's all, folks.